Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, and welcome to Indie Streak. My name is Rachel Galvin, and as you know, I interview film industry professionals on this show. If you've missed any of the shows, you can go back and listen to the archives. Well, today I'm interviewing Ruth Kalish, the producer of Complicit, and I think I have her on the line. Let me check here. Okay.
Yes.
Ruth, are you there?
Yes, you're on the line.
Hi.
Hi, Rachel.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'm going to dive right in. Tell us a little bit about the synopsis of Complicit.
Complicit is a documentary film that explores the impact of World War II Jewish refugee issues on the Roosevelt legacy. And it's done through a mythical courtroom drama that puts Franklin Roosevelt on trial for complicity in crimes against humanity. It also includes never-before-seen footage of special envoy for global anti-Semitism, Hannah Rosenthal, and her powerful expose of America's inadequate response to the Jewish refugee crisis. Probably one of the key things in the film is the September 2012 State Department ceremony where Deputy Secretary William Burns makes the first ever apology to a delegation of surviving passengers from the refugee ship SS St. Louis. In the audience is a delegation of high-ranking diplomats and foreign service officers. The final portion of the film are very candid interviews with some of the survivors of the SS St. Louis tragedy. And we see a glimpse into the extraordinary contributions some of them have made to American society. So all in all, Complicit integrates painful history with compelling drama.
Yeah, it was very interesting. This is a story that I didn't know about, that over 900 Jewish refugees came from Germany here trying to seek refuge in America and were turned away. I was really surprised. I didn't know anything about it. Why do you think this was kind of swept under the table and a lot of people don't know about this history?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, in more recent years, it's been recognized by many historians as the key event, as a signal to the beginning of the Holocaust. At the time, these 937 Jewish refugees, I'll give you a little historical background now, these 937 refugees, most of the men had been in Dachau and Buchenwald, and they had been interned there by the Nazis right after Kristallnacht in November 1938. They were released by the Nazis, told to leave within so many hours. They were given, they were bought landing permits to go into Cuba on the luxury liner SS St. Louis. Prior to this sailing, a number of ships had left Germany for Cuba with Jewish refugees. So these passengers bought landing permits, but at the time they were en route, even before they got to Cuba, Cuba terminated their landing permits. So by the time they got to Cuba, they weren't allowed off the ship. Now, why did nobody know about this? Actually, it was in the papers and was on the front page of the Miami Herald in June of 1939. But and there were instances of the passengers telegramming their telegramming the president, telegramming Eleanor Roosevelt. But like in most cases during the Holocaust, the following Holocaust period, these were buried by the media, and in many cases, the New York Times buried articles on the 10th page of the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't very well publicized. And, of course, it was a black mark on America to send back a ship of Jewish refugees trying to escape the Nazi terror that was about to occur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really interesting, the element of Joe Kennedy's involvement. I thought that was really interesting, too.
Well, Joseph Kennedy was appointed ambassador to the King James Court, United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And many think that was a big mistake because Joseph Kennedy had a history both prior to and during his tenure as ambassador, American ambassador to the King James Court. He had Nazi sympathies and was actually given an award by Hitler during his tenure, Kennedy's tenure as ambassador. And it was believed by many that Kennedy did not have the credentials to be ambassador to the United Kingdom, and this was the most important ambassadorship of America that there was. So there are many who believe that this political appointment was not in either America's best interest, or certainly not the Jews' best interest.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And how did you find the refugees to interview them? Did you interview them, or did someone else within your crew interview them?
Well, that's very interesting. Actually, the refugees that and their whereabouts was researched by Scott Miller, curator for the U.S. Holocaust Museum, back about 7 years ago, no, maybe 8 years ago, when he and his colleague wrote a book called Refuge Denied. And they were able, over a period of a few years, to uncover the whereabouts of every one of the passengers. And that's what gave them the information of who had died, where they went. And since that time, the U.S. Holocaust Museum has kept a record of that. And about 3.5 years ago, our foundation, the SS St. Louis Legacy Project Foundation, working with one of the survivors, Herbert Carliner, who was the main contact of the survivor group, started working on the 70th anniversary to get as many of the passengers, surviving passengers, together as we could. We were able to identify in 2009 about 70 living passengers around the world, most of them in the U.S., and we contacted them and sponsored 33 of the passengers who were able to come to Miami to the first ever assembly of the passengers in America. Some of them had come together in Canada over the years, but never had an American group sponsored them to come together. So at that time, we, through our foundation, started the interview. At that time, we interviewed for about an hour each of the surviving passengers that came to the event. We also interviewed at that time some of the key people who came and spoke at the event, the head of the Joint Distribution Committee, Dr. Irving Smokler, Scott Miller from the U.S. Holocaust Museum, Ari Zev from the Shoah Foundation, and many others. Since then, over the years, we've identified a few more of the passengers and have since interviewed them, actually interviewing about four that we had not identified before at our when we held our meeting in September in 2012 at the State Department ceremony. We actually had an event the night before at which we had Stuart Eisenstadt, ambassador to the European Union, speak. Also, some of the survivors spoke, and we interviewed the last few. We now have an archive of interviews of 38 of the surviving passengers. There are currently, it's believed, to be about 50 to 55 left in the world, and we have interviewed 38 of them.
That's great. Wow. Did it surprise you? I know the film talks about how some of them did return to the United States and made amazing contributions here, and they seem to have this sense of pride about America. Did that type of patriotism really surprise you?
Well, in some cases, yes, in some cases, no. Let me speak to that specifically. One thing we were quite surprised at as we began to interview over the period of the last few years, the men who came to America, the male surviving passengers, almost all of them served in one branch of the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm.
Since at the time of the sailing, the passengers who are still alive were children on the boat, as old as about 17, 18 years old, and so they'd now be into their 90s. But some of those who were able to come to America in the year or so after the ship was turned back to Europe ended up being drafted and served in the Second World War. One of them, Fred Buff, actually was in the Navy during the Second World War. Some of the others were drafted, such as Philip Freund, Herb Carliner, and many of the others, and they were drafted and served in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Herb Carliner jokes that America didn't want him in 1939, but they drafted him in 1950.
Yeah, we want you.
We want you. A few of those, like Philip Freund, at the time that he was drafted, he wasn't even a American citizen. And so he was drafted, and before he went to his basic training, he became a U.S. citizen. Hmm. So that was surprising how much they not only served our country, but served in a military capacity. The other thing that was quite evident as we spoke to many of them is the amazing contributions some of them have made. Dr. Matulski, Arno Matulski, has served, went on to become a professor in Seattle, Washington, at the University of Washington, and a renowned geneticist. Hans Fischer became a neurochemist and a professor at Rutgers. Saul Messenger became a dentist and up in Buffalo. Tom Jacobson, who was in the film, went on to become a constitutional lawyer and also for 50 years served in that capacity fighting for justice. So the contributions have been amazing. Another one of the survivors who we've interviewed is a woman who's a cantor in New York, and she went. Mm-hmm. She was one of the youngest on the ship, and she went on to become a cantor and still serves as such in New York.
Mm-hmm. Great. It must have been emotional to listen to some of these stories and how they told their feelings at the time. Did they remember a lot of what happened at the time?
Well, Some of them did, depending on their age. Some of the younger ones were told the story by their parents or by other family members. Some of the ones like Herb Carliner, who was 12 at the time of the sailing, remembered a great deal. I think the tragedy was actually some of them were either hidden in French farmhouses or by people hiding Jews. And by the time the war was over, they were already 9, 10, 11 years old and remember their experiences. And so some of them had horrible experiences hiding from the Nazis during the war. Some of them actually were in concentration camps. And so it's the story of many of the survivors of the Holocaust. Horrible tragedy. And some of them are still bitter at the United States, but many of them have gone on and recognized that America was trying to win the war, and eventually these were lucky people, and they survived.
Why do you think that FDR did this? What is your feeling about the political climate and what was going on, and why FDR would turn them away?
Well, let's put it into the realm of FDR and the State Department. And I'll go back and give you a little history. Remember, this was 1939. We had come out of a depression. Many Americans were still concerned about their finances, their having jobs. America did not want to be dragged into the war. And Roosevelt was very much aware of that. So there was that side. There was also the side that there was a growing Nazi presence in America. The American Nazi group was very active, holding rallies in numerous cities. So that was going on. And there was some Nazi sympathy. In addition to that, there was the political side. There is evidence to show that Roosevelt was wanting to go for a third term. And there was no precedent to that in America. The last back as far as George Washington, nobody had ever served more than two terms. So on the one hand, he was hoping to go for a third term and planning on it. At the same time, he was letting his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, believe that Roosevelt would support Hull if Hull wanted to run. Secretly, Cordell Hull was worried because his wife came from Jewish ancestry. And although she was on the New York Society Register, she did that using her former married name, not her Jewish name. So there was the side of political where Roosevelt was planning to run for a third term, not telling Hull, making Hull believe that he would support Hull, and Hull concerned that it would get out that his wife was Jewish. So there was a lot of concern that if they supported the Jewish cause, that would come back to bite either of them. In the meantime, the American Jews were very disorganized, even though Rabbi Singer was believed to be representing many Jews. The Jewish response to what was happening in Europe and Kristallnacht was not cohesive. There were those who said, let's not make waves, let's not make waves about what's going on in Europe. It'll make it worse for the European Jews. So there wasn't a cohesive approach to either Roosevelt or members of his cabinet who were Jewish.
This must have been very difficult. There's so many pieces of information. How did you figure out what to piece into the film?
Well, actually, we decided to make the film as a short documentary. It's now 48 minutes. And we realized that there would be some things we had to leave out. However, we did it in three acts. The first act of the film being a history of the boat and its sailing, and the second act being the mock or mythical trial. The third act being the atonement, the United States apology in Washington this past year. And the fourth act being interviews with some of the surviving passengers.
Mm-hmm.
When we got finished with it, we realized that once we began to show it, and the first showing was only this past Monday, May 6th,
mm-hmm.
there was an outcry from those who saw it, who both praised it and said, we want to know more, we want to see more. And so our plan is this summer to extend it to a full-length feature. And we certainly have enough footage between the rest of the mythical trial, the interviews. One of the things we did not put in the film was a very little known piece of information. Back in the spring of 2009, the U.S. Senate passed a resolution, Resolution 111, acknowledging America's role in the turning away of the St. Louis. First time this had ever been done by Congress, by the Senate, etc. And that resolution was passed and promoted with the work of Colonel Philip Freund, one of the surviving passengers, who is from Milwaukee, and urged his senator to move forward on that. So the resolution was passed, and at the 2009 anniversary that I just spoke of earlier of the passengers in Miami, all 33 or 34 of the passengers who were there signed formal copies of the resolution. Very few people know about that resolution.
Wow.
At the event in December 2009 in Miami, one of the head archivists for the National Archives, Richard Hunt, accepted the resolution and talked about its importance to American history. And in September 2012, he invited a group of the passengers to the National Archives, brought them into the vault where it was stored, and had a ceremony talking to them about the other documents in there and reiterating the importance of it. I was at the ceremony. It was amazing and awesome. And that component will be in the extended version. And it goes to show how important both the U.S. Senate and America over time has realized the importance of the SS St. Louis. A little known piece of information on top of that, a few months ago, a book was published by two historians. The book is called FDR and the Jews. And in it, those historians makes a statement that the U.S. Coast Guard never sent the ship away from U.S. shores. Well, that has been totally refuted by a number of the surviving passengers. They've sent letters to the editor. They've gone publicly saying that the U.S. Coast Guard did indeed blare to the ship to turn away, to get out of U.S. waters. And on top of that, there is a document from the captain of the SS St. Louis, Captain Schroeder, in his files and in his documentation. He notes that the ship turned away because the U.S. Coast Guard told him to turn away and to get out of U.S. waters. Hmm. So there are some things that will come out in the expanded version, along with additional interviews, as well as some parts of the play that are the mythical trial that had not been in this first version of the movie.
Mm-hmm. I saw a thank you to Hillary Clinton in the back. Did you work with Hillary Clinton or any of the State Department people directly to help you with this?
Yes, we certainly did. Let me tell you how it came about. We were at in 2012, we were doing a presentation of the play, actually at, October 2011. At Georgetown University. And a member of the State Department's Division of Anti-Semitism and Global Anti-Semitism was attending and mentioned to us that she would bring this to the highest levels of the State Department. Following that, we were contacted and began to deal with members of the State Department, and they were able to do a couple of things which were amazing. They not only wanted us to come to the State Department and bring a delegation, but they wanted this play, The Trial of FDR, to be put on in front of the diplomatic corps and foreign service officers.
Wow.
Hillary Clinton was supposed to be at the event, but unfortunately, Libya was attacked a few days before, she had Deputy Secretary William Burns speak on her behalf. But she did send a memo to the foreign service officers about announcing this beforehand, saying, and I'll summarize, she wanted that the State Department foreign service officers and diplomats to know that when they left their offices every day, that the decisions they made had an impact, and she wanted them to realize the impact and the importance of the decisions they made.
Wow.
And the State Department actually did a full videotaping of the entire event ceremony on September 24th, 2012 at the State Department. And following the ceremony, we got a notice from them saying that the videotape would be going to embassies and foreign service officers of the U.S. all over the world, requesting that they all see it.
Wow. That's
so
great.
It was of great importance of putting right and recognizing both the decisions that were made and basically saying, we don't want to ever do this again.
That's pretty poignant what she said, given the Libyan situation was happening at the same time.
Yeah, that's really
interesting. Now,
the morning of our event, she was at the opening of the United Nations, so she was not able to attend the event, but she did have very high up people from the State Department at the event, and of course the Belgium ambassador was there.
Mm-hmm.
Antwerp, Belgium was where the ship docked when it returned to Europe. And it was there that the passengers were dispersed to the four countries that took them in, and including Belgium. So the Belgium ambassador spoke at the September 24th, 2012 event, and it was a very moving, inspirational talk that he had.
But a lot of Jews ended up back in Germany, right?
Well,
part of the Holocaust.
Actually, yeah, what happened is four countries took them in once they arrived back in Antwerp. On the way back, actually the ship was ordered back by the Nazis, the German government, and there was a delegation that went of the Jews who went to the captain, and the captain promised them that he would never drop them back and get them back to Germany, that he'd scuttle the ship before that happened. So during the week or so that they were on their way back to Europe, different governments under the Joint Distribution Committee were able to get England, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands to take about a fourth and a fourth and a fourth and a fourth each.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, that was in June of 2009, and I mean 1939, and within months, Germany invaded Poland, and then proceeded to invade France, Belgium, and Holland. So
uh-huh.
those who went to France, Belgium, and Holland, many of them then were sent to concentration camps, many to Auschwitz, and died there. It turned out that in some cases, the younger Jewish refugees were spared, either by being hidden or they were singled out because the parents went. So in some cases, they survived. And, of
mm-hmm.
course, those who went to England survived.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had the showing at the movie of Del Rey and Lake Worth. We're running out of time, but I do want you to tell us, you know, where else can people see this? Is there a website? You know, how can people see the film?
Well, we've scheduled five showings for the month of May. We had two already. The next three are as follows. Movies of Del Rey on May 20th at 4 o'clock. Movies of Del Rey May 22nd, 4 o'clock. That's a Monday and a Wednesday. Movies of Lake Worth at 7 p.m. And that's our final showing for this round. We will be expanding the film, but we will also be going into different cities. We have already scheduled for the rest of 2013 to Milwaukee. We'll be going to the University of Arizona. We have another very big planned event in June. We've been asked by the head of the Holocaust Commission, Education Commission for the state of New Jersey, to come up there to plan a statewide program with them.
Okay,
I'm part, I'm an associate director of the SS St. Louis Legacy Project Foundation. And what we do is we do education through drama. And our focus is on issues of human rights, immigration, refugee policy. And our goal is to promote awareness and dialogue on key issues that are important in history. And at this time, we're dealing with issues of the SS St. Louis.
Okay. And, do you have a website that you want to give out before we leave? Because we're running out of time.
Absolutely. Our website is stlouislegacyproject.org. Lewis, L-O-U-I-S, legacyproject.org. And it's quite informative.
Okay, and that will the film also be on that website?
The film will not be on the website. There will be little segments of it. The film is proprietary.
For the information.
Okay. It's proprietary to the foundation.
Okay, yeah, I meant the information so that people would see, like,
the
where they're showing
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. And as we have future showings, it'll also be on our events page of the website.
Okay, perfect. Great. Well, this is, I could go on and on, but we're running out of time. Thank you so much for being on, Rachel.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And if you expand it, you know, maybe I can bring you back on the show again and we can talk some more.
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you so much.
Okay, and I will talk to you soon. Thanks, Ruth.
Thank you. Thank you, Rachel.
Bye. Bye. Okay, well, that was a very eye-opening conversation with Ruth Kalish. I recommend checking out the film just to inform yourself because it's something that I didn't know about, and I was a history major. So, you know, maybe I learned it, but I don't remember it, and so it was definitely interesting to learn about this. And if you're in history, into history at all, or especially Jewish history, then I would definitely go to one of those screenings and check out the film. You can go back and listen to this in its entirety if you missed the dates and listen to it again. Also, go to the website that she mentioned and check it out. Okay. Well, thanks for tuning in today, guys. And as you know, I'll be back next Sunday at 1 o'clock. And if you're a filmmaker out there and you'd like to be on the show, you can always email me. My email address is ravenprods@yahoo.com. ravenprods@yahoo.com. And a couple little tidbits. Right now, this weekend, is the 48-hour film festival is going on. And I wanted to let you know that if you are down here in Florida and you want to check out the screening of those films, that it will be held on May 17th and 18th at 7 and 9 p.m. at the Hollywood Central Performing Arts Center, which is at 1770 Monroe Street. And it's $14, and that includes the party, which is always a nice networking opportunity if you're in the film industry. And the awards will be held on the 18th at 9 p.m. If you want more information about that, it's too late for you to get in as a filmmaker on that. But you can check them out and see who wins. The website is 48hourfilm.com/Miami. Now, also, there's another film festival coming up, but the deadline is tomorrow. It's called Swede Fest, and it will be held up in Palm Beach in July, July 27th, and it's kind of an interesting, little different film festival. If you don't know about it, I would definitely check out the website. It's www.swedefest.palmbeach.com, and the deadline, if you're a filmmaker and you want to get involved in that, is tomorrow, May 13th, so get on it. You have tonight to put it together. I'm sure you can come up with something. It's a little easier, I think, to come up with something for Swede Fest. They've got some pretty interesting categories and things that they do up there. So check it out. I think this is the second year. I'm not positive. It's fairly new, the Swede Fest. But that's about it for today, guys. I want to say Happy Mother's Day. Boy, I can't say that. Happy Mother's Day to everyone that's out there. And like I said, I'll be back next week. So do tune in next Sunday at 1 o'clock. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.